You are listening to the GeoNiagara Radio Show, sponsored by the Department of Geography and Tourism Studies at Brock University.
Welcome to the GeoNiagara Radio Show. You're listening to Season 2, Episode 4. We'd like to welcome you to the show. Today's guest will be Tony Shaw from the Department of Geography and Tourism Studies at Brock University.
So, Rachel, I was on the Brock University website the other day, and I noticed, of all things, that it was exam time already.
It is exam time. It is extreme crunch time right now. Classes just ended, and yeah, we are getting into the thick of it.
So what classes are you wrapping up this term?
This term I'll be wrapping up environmental sustainability, biogeography, glacial geomorphology, research in cultural geography to start. Research in cultural geography was probably my most interesting course of the semester. I was able to work on a month-long project where I analyzed music and how music influences atmosphere and domestic space. And it was really nice to work on this project because Mike Rittmeister gave me a lot of freedom to pick a topic however I choose. And he helped me through the process a lot. And I was able to do autoethnographic research. So I was journaling every day and completing narrative responses on how I influenced my own atmosphere and what sort of mediums I was using to play music with and how far the music would reach and how far the atmosphere was reach based on which mediums I was using and what feelings I could react to within my home, which is a very comfortable space for me.
So when you say atmosphere, do you mean like the mood of the space or does it go deeper than that?
It can absolutely go deeper than that. I'm talking about the mood of the space. I'm talking about the feelings that are invoked when I'm putting on a particular music. And I'm talking about what level of satisfaction I get after I've picked music that matches the atmosphere I want to achieve.
So do you have like a control room for that? Like a room with all the lights on as opposed to a room with no lights on and candles? Because that would play a part in the mood of the music would be the space that's occurring in if it's a dark room as opposed to a light room.
Yeah, absolutely. So sometimes I would comment that outside influences were impacting the atmosphere. So say if it was a rainy day outside, I might have chosen a more mellow, relaxed, maybe indie type of genre to match my mood of the day. I can't say I have a control room, but I can say that part of the project and part of my credibility was to keep all of my experiences as natural as possible. So when listening to music, I would complete all of the regular activities I would go through in a day, and I would comment on what changes in atmosphere or disruptions I noticed.
So this was like a full-term project?
Mm-hmm. It was a full-term project. Starting in September, I observed myself for 28 days and over 20 listening sessions, and I collected about 14 hours worth of musical data.
Very cool.
Thank you. Yes. Very relevant to hear, I hope.
Yeah. So in my last few days, I was interviewed by a podcaster that is out of Virginia. His name is Joe Bob Penner. He hosts the Everyday Geo podcast. And I spent about an hour with Joe Bob on the phone using a Skype type of thing, but it's not. It was called Zencaster.
And
cool. It's really cool because what happens is you open up the session, you record your session, your session is recorded on your track, and then after the session is done, it automatically uploads it to his user profile. So his track is on one track, and my track is on another track, and then he can edit them together.
Wow.
Which was really cool. We did experience some little bit of technical difficulties, but it was nothing that was overly complicating to the interview. But I love his interviewing style because the whole show is about interviewing people that use geospatial technologies, just sort of the everyday guy or girl that's using the technology. He's not interested in doing interviews with vice presidents of big corporations or that sort of thing. He just sort of wants to know what you do in a day, which is really cool. So we threw up a link on the Geospatial Niagara website to his site, and we'll also throw a link into the show notes for this episode to Everyday Geo. And we talked a little bit about Geospatial Niagara and some of the projects that we had going on the go. And it was really fun. I really enjoyed it.
It's very refreshing that he would decide to not necessarily focus on the vice presidents and the presidents and the CEOs of the world and just focus on the everyday activities of normal people that are in fact using these geospatial technologies that we talk about all the time.
And I want to give a shout out to Leighton for... it's because of her that getting in contact with Joe Bob that the interview was made possible. So thank you, Leighton, for helping me out with that. Much appreciated.
Awesome.
Joining us in the studio this week is Dr. Tony Shaw from Brock University's Department of Geography and Tourism Studies. Welcome to the show, Dr. Shaw.
Thank you.
First question that we have is a question that we generally ask all of our guests, and is, could you give us a little bit of background on your educational path?
Yes. Coming from Guyana, a small country in northern South America, I was exposed to geography because it was offered in the high school curriculum. But most of it, of course, was basically looking at regional geography, capital of cities and background to various countries and regions in terms of human activities and physical activities, climate and vegetation, and so on and so forth. But one thing I found even back then was the interrelationship between human activities and the physical environment. And those two areas, of course, constitute, if you will, the core of geography, because it's not just about studying the human environment, but also how humans interact with their physical environment, how they impact their physical environment, and how the physical environment, in fact, affect human activities. So going back to my days in high school in Guyana, that's where it all started. And of course, when I started my undergraduate at Wilfrid Laurier back in the late 70s, I studied physical geography primarily at Wilfrid Laurier. And of course, I did a program in history. So the two, of course, were two areas of major concentration. But of course, I was more interested in geography because that is the one area I felt I could excel. And that fascinated me in terms of the very important role of the environment and how we need to understand the environment, both the physical and the human.
Who inspired you to become a geographer? Was it any one professor or one teacher?
I have to say there's no one particular individual. In high school, I would say there were a number of teachers who spoke very eloquently about geography. And I have to say there were a number of volunteer teachers with Peace Corps back in the late 60s and 70s, and including CUSO, which is a Canadian University Students Overseas, and VSO. These were British volunteers. And these were people who did degrees in geography. And they were very, very enthusiastic about the subject. And that enthusiasm, of course, got me infected as well. So I have to say a number of people certainly back in my high school who inspired me. And of course, once I came to university, exposure to professors, certainly at Wilfrid Laurier, I think, made a big difference. So the discipline, of course, as I said, is fairly broad discipline. So depending on your area of concentration, I was more concerned with physical geography, climatology, geomorphology, soils, and so on and so forth. And of course, later on, when I went on to do master's and PhD, I sort of branched out into agricultural development planning, which is all part of geography as well.
What classes are you currently teaching at Brock?
I'm teaching primarily climatology and meteorology, and of course in sustainability. Also, I'm involved in the Cool Climate and Enology Viticulture Institute, and I teach a course on climate and grapevine production. But much of my teaching and research focus on the physical side. But I do have a very, very strong interest in terms of the human impact. And this, when we talk about sustainability, I think it's an understanding of not only the physical side, but also the human system. So those two areas, of course, are the two broad areas that I continue to focus on. But my specialization in terms of teaching and research tend to be primarily on in the area of climatology and meteorology. And those are two very important areas that you can appreciate. Meteorology, of course, has to do with day-to-day understanding of the weather. And we know we spend literally billions of dollars trying to forecast the weather and try to understand how weather can affect human activities and economic activities. And so that's a very important area in addition to climatology, which is more the study of long-term weather conditions and how they also affect our environment in terms of agriculture and various other activities.
So I spent a little bit of time on your website on the Brock Geography page, and you have varied research interests as illustrated by the various publications, but you seem to be best known for your work in viticulture. How did that interest become about?
Well, as someone said, you know, the wine industry is like the canary in a mine. Back in the good old days, when you are hesitant to venture into the mine because of the buildup of methane gas, you send a canary, and if the canary survives, you know it's okay. If it doesn't, then you think twice about going down there. And when it comes to the wine industry, climate is the number one factor in terms of where you can successfully commercialize viticulture that is growing various varieties of grapes, especially the European varieties. So when we look at the distribution, for for example, of tender fruit industry, which is peach, cherry, and so on and so forth, and of the viticulture industry, which is primarily to do with grape production. Those areas where we have successful viticulture and fruit production are largely determined by moderate climate. So, for example, the Niagara region is considered to be the biggest viticulture and tender fruit area in Canada, and primarily because of the relatively mild climate, both in the winter and in the summer. But also when we look outside of Ontario, the Naples Valley, which is a very important fruit production area, and the climate is an important factor, southern Quebec. And of course, we hop, skip across the Canadian Prairie into the Okanagan area and southern Fraser Valley and parts of Victoria Island. We know that those areas that successfully grow grapes on a commercial basis for excellent wines, those areas are very much determined by their climate. Of course, not to say that the topography and soils are not important, but when we look to identify new areas for fruit production and grape production, we first tend to look at the climate, and secondly, we look at the soils and the topography, topoclimatology as it's called.
What are the challenges and or the benefits of climate change with respect to Niagara's wine industry?
I know in general, we tend to be dwelling on the negative impacts of climate change. And to some extent, we can see the extremes that are occurring in weather, whether it be occurrence of heavy snowfall, or where we see, for example, drought or excessive precipitation, or we're seeing more severe storms such as tornadoes and hurricanes. I mean, and those are some concerns and problems associated with climate change, because as the ocean warms up, we tend to see much more severe hurricanes, because the source of the energy for these systems, of course, is the warm surface water. So there's no question about that. When we look at major floods in Canada, and of course floods are now becoming probably the number one climatic hazard across Canada, they're very much associated with a warming climate and fairly severe conditions. But at the same time, a country such as Canada, which is very, very big, geographically very, very diverse, with lots of different climatic regions and ecosystems, there are some beneficial impacts of climate change, and certainly for the wine industry, because the number one limitation to grape production, of course, are very cold winters, where we have cold winters, of course, and you have very severe winters, you cannot grow grapes successfully because you have major winter damage. But with climate change, we're seeing some moderation of the winter climates, and we're not seeing as many severe temperatures going down to minus 20 and lower, which tend to be the temperatures at which you tend to have major bud damage, primary bud damage. Those conditions are ameliorating, but one of the concerns that still remains with climate change is that you tend to have what we call volatility. That is, you tend to have major variability both in the seasonal conditions but also on an annual basis. So for the wine industry, that's a concern. But we are seeing warmer temperatures, for example, in the Niagara area, which allows us to grow some of the varieties that we were not able to grow normally. But of course, that is something that has to be considered as the climate evolves. And so some of the work that I'm doing on the long-term trend in especially temperature, because temperature seem to be the number one factor. We do look at precipitation, but it doesn't seem to have the same impact as temperature, because temperature determines the length of the growing season, the frost-free period, and so on and so forth, and the ability of certain varieties to reach full potential. So what's happening in the Niagara region, for example, over the last 50 years, we're seeing a steady increase in the growing season temperature, which allows some of the red varieties, for example, Cabernet Sauvignon, which is a variety we've had difficulty growing because we don't have enough heat, especially in the latter part of the growing season. What we're finding now in the Niagara region is that our spring is starting earlier, and there's an extension of the fall season. So these so-called late season varieties have the chance to reach full maturity, which then impacts the industry in a very favorable way, because we can, in fact, see an improvement in wine quality, especially the red varieties. Mine, of course, there are some concern with warmer temperatures, especially in the latter part of the growing season, because some varieties mature at a very high temperatures, and that then could affect the quality of the wine. So ideally, we like to see a gradual warming in the spring, peaks in the summer, and a gradual decline in the fall season temperature. We're not seeing that all the time, but we have what we call vintage years when the conditions are ideal and we have a good high quality wine. In some years, of course, we have a short, cool, wet growing season, and that then impacts the quality of the wine. So climate change, one of the things is that you do have some challenges because we're seeing this variability, and that then makes it very difficult for the winemakers to have what we call consistency and quality. Because as you know, consumers like to, when they buy wines, they like to see that this vintage tastes good, but next year vintage would say it tastes probably just as good or even better. And that is something that the growers and the winemakers have to grapple with. They're adjusting, they're adapting to these changes, and they're doing a great job of adapting to climate change in spite of all the challenges that may be facing.
So back in 2011, when I was doing my thesis project at Niagara College, we were investigating a new wine region in Ontario, Ontario South Coast in Norfolk County. Are there any other new growing regions in Ontario, and are there any that have surprised you?
Well, I think the next area that will probably come on stream would be Huron County and Gray County. Those two areas, of course, on the eastern shore of Lake Huron, we have to say Lake Ontario is one of the biggest influence on the success of wine production in Ontario. Lake Erie to some extent, but as you know, Lake Ontario remains ice-free, and that's what moderates the winter temperatures, but also summer temperatures. What we're seeing is that Lake Huron, also we're seeing a higher percentage of ice-free surface, which means that any cold winds coming out of the northwest flowing over Lake Huron would be moderated. So Lake Huron and Gray County, those areas, in fact, already have successful vineyards and wineries in those areas, and I see those areas as emerging as very important area. Norfolk County, I suspect, hopefully this year, would probably be the fourth wine appellation in Ontario. They're very, very enthusiastic about the grapes grown there and the wines made. And that area, of course, tobacco was the number one crop. And of course, tobacco has declined considerably. But farmers in that area have switched to other crops quite successfully. And so the wine industry in Norfolk County, I can see that in years to come to be a very, very successful area. And agritourism, which is a very important aspect of the industry, alleviates an area because we are dealing here with not just wine, but also local food, restaurants, and so on and so forth. And so the wine industry has the potential to really resuscitate some of these areas that are really having a difficult time, especially in the face of importation of cheap food from abroad.
I was really amazed visiting Norfolk County from like the time that I went down there, and I guess it would have been 2010 when there were really only two wineries that were beginning. And last year I went down there and there was at least five or six that have established themselves. So it's really exciting to see that growing down there. Could you tell us a little bit about some of your current projects that you're working on?
Yes, we've had a major project that was funded by the Ontario Research Foundation. A number of people were involved in that project in Covey and outside of Covey as well. And I was tasked with looking at the impact of climate change, principally in Ontario. So I was looking, I'm still looking at how the climate in Ontario is evolving and looking at identifying new areas for grape wine production. And so that is the project I'm working on, but also there's still need to develop sub-appellations. We've done the work for the Niagara region, and I'm very proud of that. We've divided the main viticulture area into 10 sub-appellations, and based on the climate, the soils, and topography of the area. And so this area is extension of viticulture above the escarpment, where previously we've had very little grapevine production. Primarily, it's a very cold area. So we're looking to identify new areas, even within the Niagara region, going towards Lake Erie, because I think in years to come, we can see successful viticulture on the Lake Erie side, as we've seen already, of course, in southwestern Ontario. So I think the Niagara region has the potential to expand the areas on the grapevine production beyond the escarpment into Lake Erie area, because I think that could make for, in my opinion, excellent area for growing, especially warm season varieties.
Outside of your work at the university, do you provide consulting services?
I've done a lot of work with what we call IRAP Industrial Assistance Research Program, which is it's a federal program which assists industry, and in this case, the wine industry or the building industry or any industry for that matter, where the individuals are trying to develop a technology or trying to improve a particular process. So I've done a lot of work with IRAP through the wine industry because in doing the sub-appellation work that to some extent was funded by the IRAP program, but also, of course, the VQA was instrumental in initiating that program, Vintners Quality Alliance. So within the wine industry, yes, the IRAP program is very important, but also I've done some work in building climatology. And of course, as you know, I'm very happy that both the federal and provincial governments are talking about energy conservation and also improving the efficiency of buildings in terms of energy use. in terms of insulation, building material, the design of the buildings, and so on and so forth, and retrofitting. And I think that's a very important area. I've done some work in building climatology, and I can see that area being a very, very important area in terms of adaptation to climate change, but also mitigation, reducing greenhouse gas, because we very seldom talk about energy conservation, but energy conservation should be also part of our strategy in terms of mitigation. And so I've done a lot of work in that area, and I still continue to do that, because I think that area would certainly make a big difference in terms of energy conservation, because close to 25% of the energy consumers, of course, is commercial buildings and family homes and so on and so forth. But industry, of course, whether it be the building industry or the construction industry or the agriculture industry, I think governments have a very important role in setting the tone in terms of providing money and institutional support to help people to address the problems of climate change. So I continue to work with industry because, you know, as a professor, you want to bring the real world, because in a lecture hall, what we're trying to do is we're trying to understand the real world, right? So the more you are interacting with the real world, you better understand the problem and you can bring into the classroom realistic solutions or more real life problems, right? Rather than simply looking at things at a theoretical or conceptual level. And I think for students in geography in general, geography is not just about classroom learning, as you know, whether it be remote sensing, whether it be physical geography, human geography, fieldwork is very, very important. And so our students in geography and Brock department are very much engaged not only in classroom activities, but also in practical work in the field, whether it be on the human side or the physical side. And I think that's so important. It's not just classroom. And so myself, I'm very much engaged in what's happening outside, and I think it has helped me a lot to bring a more realistic approach to the discipline in terms of my experience with industry. And so I consider that to be a very important aspect. And as you know, there are field trips to Peterborough every year, plus each course might have a number of field trips, whether it be on the human side or the physical side, where students are actually out there. And I think that's the good thing about geography. I think we're able to bring together both the human and the physical in terms of interaction. And when we talk about environmental problems, yes, you need to understand the physical environment, how it operates. But at the same time, we need to understand the human dimension, because both are very much interrelated. And so that's the tone for geography. So anyone entering the discipline itself, it's no small wonder that many of our people who are involved in development issues, environmental issues, and so on and so forth, come from a broad discipline such as geography, so they have that perspective. And many of our planners, whether it be rural planners, urban planners, environment planners, are coming from a background in geography. And I think the discipline has made a very, very important contribution to looking at real-world problems and solving real-world problems.
At the top of your answer, you mentioned the field of building climatology. This, to me, seems like a relatively new field. Like, when I would think of building climatology, the layperson would probably think, is it too warm or too cold in the building? But does that include things like the establishment of green roofing technology or rainwater harvesting and things like that?
Yes, definitely. Because, you know, you probably heard of the term zero energy homes, right? And the whole idea is that to make homes more energy independent, right? Energy efficient as well, but also independence. Because as you know, we have homes that are off the grid and they're able to generate their own electricity, whether it be primarily through, of course, using solar panels, and they derive their water from the roof and so on and so forth. But even in the urban environment, it is quite possible. And we are seeing that houses now are being designed. I did some work with a company called Thermopan, and the whole idea was to create a home, very efficient walls. The external walls, of course, reduce the loss and the gain of energy lost during the winter months and gained during the summer months, but also to use, for example, geothermal to provide heating and cooling during the summer and winter months. So it is quite possible to design these homes to create their own energy. And if you do have extra energy, that could be fed into the grid so that it makes the system less vulnerable to the problems we associate with electricity being generated from a central system, which makes it extremely vulnerable. So the vulnerability, we can reduce quite significantly the vulnerability of individuals or their family by creating our own source of energy. And that is something that we need to aim at, because as you know, as our society becomes more and more technologically sophisticated, we're becoming more and more vulnerable. This is why someone on a farm is far less vulnerable than someone in an urban environment. Okay, and so if we can develop those systems within the urban environment that create our own energy and become less dependent on the grid or a central facility, that I think would be a great, great thing. And I think that both the federal and provincial government have recognized that. And you see now in the newspaper and in the weeklies, talk of zero energy, right? Zero energy, in other words, more independent source of energy generation. And that is becoming an important thing. So you go into some of these developing countries in the middle of nowhere, you have someone with a solar panel and a cell phone, right? They don't have a central phone, but they write into the cell phone. But now they have electricity in their home that they never were able to do so, right? From a solar panel. And they can run a small fridge, they can run their small television set, and they can actually read at night when the kids they couldn't, right? I mean, I grew up in Guyana, a very poor country back then, using an oil lamp with kerosene in a bottle, usually a Coke bottle. You use a Coke, you don't toss the Coke bottle out. You keep it, put kerosene in it and a wick, and you use that as a lamp. Nowadays, I go back there and I see in the middle of nowhere, they have a solar panel, and that one panel is able to generate enough electricity for people to read. The kids can read, right? And even run a small fridge and a small TV. So it can be done. It's been done, right? And this is a good thing about renewable energy. It is making even the small, poor farmers a bit more independent. And that is something that we need to look at very, very seriously for a country such as Canada, because energy in Canada is still relatively cheap. Electricity is still relatively cheap. And that could be, that might change, but certainly that's one area we need to look at very carefully.
What has been the most rewarding work that you've done?
Wow, that's a good one. I've done so much work because, I mean, at the beginning when I finished university, a lot of the research I did was in Green Revolution technology, which was the big thing back in the 1960s and 70s. Population, then there was a big concern about population growth and not be able to grow enough food to feed the masses, right? And so the Green Revolution, which is development of hybrid varieties of corn and wheat and so on and so forth, and rice, that in many countries, especially countries such as in Asia, more self-sufficient in food. So I was looking at the innovation, how that innovation actually spreads and what are some of the obstacles to farmers in adopting that. And I thought that was very important. I study and my PhD dissertation was on agricultural development planning, looking at the diffusion of highly yielding varieties in the developing countries. And I thought, for me, that was a very important step for me. And I value that research, and it's still being done, you know, looking at food production in terms of self-sufficiency and more efficient way of producing cheaper food. But later on, I moved into climatology because I did both in my master's and PhD. I did some climatology. And my master's was in climatology. And I began to look at here in Canada, looking at pollution. I did quite a bit of work for Environment Ontario in looking at air pollution in the Niagara region in Ontario, looking at especially ozone. Ozone was very problematic because of the emissions, pollution, and so on and so forth, right? So that work progressed. And then I moved into looking at climate and grapevine production because in the 1980s, the industry began to see some expansion with people such as Carl Kaiser. God bless his soul. He just recently passed away. He's done a tremendous work for the industry along with Donald Zeraldo, John Marinissim, Cave Spring, Shadow the Charms, Paul Boss. These are the pioneers in industry. Some of them are still around. I got into the industry. I started looking at the use of wind machines. So that was a very important study that was done back in 2000 because, as you know, winter is still our nemesis in this area here. So we're looking at whether wind machines can work in this area. And the IRAP program, in fact, provided the funds to do that research. And six wineries collaborated. And I was the one who carried out the fieldwork to look at the role of inversions, because on a night when it's clear and calm, you have this warmer air above, an inversion, and below, of course, at canopy level, you have very cool air, and how we can bring that warm air with using a wind machine to ameliorate the temperatures and prevent winter freeze damage. So I consider that a very, very important study, because in 2003, when we did the study, it was a very, very cold winter, and by then, Shadow the Charms had installed 17 wind machines, and they were able to save their crop. Mr. Paul Boss was laughing all the way to the bank and back, right? While many of the growers, in fact, suffered major damage. The following year, many people saw what was happening, and they started installing wind machines. And so I've done a lot of feasibility studies throughout southern Ontario, looking at areas that are ideal for wind machines, but not all areas can actually use wind machines. Prince Edward County cannot. It's way too cold. We on the southern shore of Lake Ontario, thank God for Lake Ontario because it ameliorates the winds as they blow over. And so even though the winds on the north shore might come start off at minus 25, 30, by the time they reach the southern shore, it might be minus 20. But away from the lake, temperature is still quite cold, and so wind machines can make a big difference. And it has made a big difference in the expansion of the industry above the escarpment and to southwestern Ontario. So I consider that a very important study. And then, of course, the sub-appellation work that I did for the VQA, I consider that also one of the hallmarks of my contribution to the wine industry. And I still continue to do research. I continue to help the industry by drinking a little bit of wine on a regular basis. I don't know if it's helping sales, but I have to say that, right?
What has been your most challenging work?
Most challenging work.
Could be the same as your most rewarding.
One of the most challenging work is drawing climatic boundaries, right? Climatic boundaries are very difficult. When you look at a map and you say, this is the boundary of this climatic zone and that climate, it's not that straightforward. A line on the map doesn't say, you know, one climate ends here, another starts here, right? And so when we draw climatic boundaries, we have to be very, very careful how we define those boundaries. And so as a geographer, you have to understand the topography. And we know that the topography has a very important influence on the local climate. So topographic boundaries can help us to actually identify climatic boundaries because the atmosphere is moving all the time, whereas these are fixed areas. A ridge or a valley remains the same, right? They behave in a consistent way, and so they influence the climate or the temperature, and it's particularly the temperature, because when we're looking at climatic boundaries, the temperature seems to be the one that we tend to be more concerned, but precipitation is much easier to identify, but temperature is a little bit more challenging. So in defining climatic boundaries, I find that very challenging. And I would be the first one to say that's one of the limitations of climatology, that when you look at climatic boundaries, you really have to be very, very careful that you don't put too much confidence in it, because boundaries can shift. Climatic boundaries can shift overnight. The Niagara region, when you have a cold front that moves through with very, very high winds, tend to have a more uniform temperature. On a night, it might be very, very clear and calm. You'll find some different temperatures closer to the lake, away from the lake, atop of the escarpment, and so on and so forth. So those boundaries will shift depending on the synoptic system. And so you have to be very, very careful when you draw these boundaries. And so I'm often asked, you know, is it safe to grow grapes in a particular area? To some extent, I have to say, maybe at your location, I can do a long-term study and maybe determine what's happening in that area and compare it to another area that is more established. And that comparison can help to at least to determine on a night when it's very, very cold, how your area behaves relative to an area which is more established. And so those are some of the tricks that we use in industry, especially to identify new areas, especially where the data is lacking and you need long-term data. And of course, remote sensing becomes very, very important. And that's a very big area in physical geography. And of course, in climatology, we're using remote sensing all the time to identify temperature, precipitation differences. But also, I mean, it's used in so many different areas. In building climatology, actually, you can see distinct differences between the urban environment, which is very much warmer, and the surrounding rural areas. We can actually see the roofs of houses and during the winter months where they're losing heat, because you can see the heat coming off the buildings being emitted. And so if you have very poor insulation in your ceiling, you can actually see the difference by looking at remote sensing. So we use remote sensing also to identify cold spots and hot spots and warm spots in an environment. And of course, now we're having not only satellites, but we can use drones, right? And that drone is becoming much more widely used. I mean, we've used it primarily for recreation at one time, but now it's more such an applied area in geography, but different areas of physical geography. And so that is one area that I think is revolutionizing data collection. And of course, as a GIS specialist yourself, know that GIS, which is a very important area in geography, and the use of these remote sensing techniques for getting data, the mapping and climatology and so on and so forth, those are some of the areas where our graduates in geography are actually finding lots of jobs, because they're very, very practical, they're very relevant, they're very important. The mining industry use a lot of drones, a lot of remote sensing techniques. And of course, now we're using it to identify within the vineyards the cold spots or hot spots. But also we can see during the winter months, in the spring, if you do some remote sensing work, you can actually see the areas that have had major damage as a result of freeze injury. Very, very important area. I can't over state the importance of geography. I'm not saying it because I'm a geographer. I'm saying because there's so many different applications, and our graduates find jobs in so many different areas. For anyone doing studying in the environment, anyone doing planning, would be urban planning, rural planning, environmental planning, it's a great discipline because it brings so many different sub-disciplines together so that the students have a fairly good perspective on the issues.
And finally, our last question is, I try to engage educators and students by these broadcasts, and I always ask the question at the end, are there any new areas of climatology where students should investigate if they're interested? What is the cutting edge of climatology right now?
Oh, that's a good one. Well, I think data management is becoming very, very important. First of all, though, one still has to understand the discipline. You need to understand the atmospheric system, because having the data is one thing, but how you interpret that information is very, very important. So while on one hand, I like to think that the techniques that we have for acquiring data and physically analyzing the data, I think that's very important, but the interpretation of that information is very, very important. You can misinterpret information as well. So for geographers, I think the cutting edge on the physical side, I can see, because I mean, on the human side is such a broad area as well, right? The physical side, I think for physical geographers, I think the cutting edge is having more training in data acquisition, whether it be by remote sensing or using drone or what have you, and data manipulation, and providing that data in an electronic form, right? So as you know, digital data is becoming very, very important, and manipulation of that data in the right way, of course, is very crucial. So those are some of the cutting edges, and our students are finding jobs in remote sensing, they're finding jobs in GIS, whether it be climatology or meteorology. The meteorology field is, you need to go a little bit higher for meteorology, because if you want to be doing weather forecasting, I mean, you can't do that by doing an introductory course in meteorology. You need to go more advanced studies, because meteorology is grounded in physics and mathematics, so you need to be fairly well versed in those areas. Whereas climatology is more statistical, meteorology is far more mathematical in terms of trying to be competent in that area. But nonetheless, they're all related. And so for students doing climate change, you need to have a very, very good grasp of climatology, because the climate is, we will be facing some very serious challenges. And as much as the situation for Canada is fairly optimistic in some areas, but you know, when we look at what's happening in the Arctic region, you know, the Arctic area is warming up at a very, very significant rate. And what are the implications for that? Some are good for the most part in terms of opening up of the area for shipping, but what are the ecological impacts? So far, nothing is considered to be positive in terms of ecological impacts. It's all seem to be on the negative side. So we need to be concerned. We need to be more conversant and more knowledgeable about what's happening. So I applaud students who are in the physical geography program and human geography program. But also, I think, as I tell them, you need to also understand what our governments are doing in terms of policies and programs, because they set the tone for development looking at the problems. We can do all the research, we have all the information, but if it's not implemented and if it's not monitored, nothing happens. So I said you need to be involved both at the local level, at the provincial level, and at the federal, but also at the national level, because you know, this world is highly interrelated. Whatever happens in Canada has an impact elsewhere. Whatever happens elsewhere has an impact in Canada. So as a globe, we need to get our act together. We need to cooperate because the problem of climate change is not going to be solved by one country. It has to be solved by all the countries of the world, poor and rich. So this is where our students need to be very much involved, not just in understanding the discipline, but also be engaged in what's happening outside of the university, outside of their municipalities, outside of their province, but outside of their country as well.
Thank you, Dr. Shaw, for your time. Appreciate it. Come back to the show anytime.
Thank you for inviting me.
Thinking of pursuing a career in the field of geography or tourism? The Department of Geography and Tourism Studies at Brock University offers 3 and 4 year bachelor's degrees and a geography graduate program, each with several study options. At Brock University, you'll get an excellent education with hands-on experience through internships, study abroad programs, co-op, labs, seminars, and more. Explore the world through your studies. Come to Brock and experience the Department of Geography and Tourism Studies today. Check us out at brocku.ca/geotour.
I'd like to thank again Dr. Tony Shaw for coming into the show and talking about his work and his experiences at Brock University. The man is amazing in the work that he does. I've had him for a number of classes at Brock, meteorology and wine grape climatology, and that man certainly changed the direction of my study in my last couple of years at Brock.
Yeah, I've had Tony Shaw before too, and for my meteorology class, and he's always so enthusiastic, even at 8 in the morning, and yeah, he was just fantastic to learn from.
So upcoming events, on Friday, January the 12th, 2018, between 11 and noon at the Schmann Tower, room 105, is the Sustainability Transdisciplinary Seminar Series. And this particular event is the case study of San Juan, Ecuador, bringing ecosystem governance for a more sustainable community by Dr. Liette Vasseur. So that is open to the public to attend. So we encourage you to come out to that event. On Saturday, January 27th, 2018, is the Niagara Go Geomatic Social at Frescos at 104th Avenue. And that is happening between the hours of 6:30 p.m. and 9:30 p.m. So come on out, talk geospatial, talk geography, talk remote sensing, enjoy some great company, some great food, and vent a little bit if you've had a rough day at work anytime during the previous week.
That about wraps up this week's episode of the GeoNiagara Radio Show.
If you want to contact us, you can do so via Twitter at GeoNiagara, and you can find us on Facebook at GeoNiagara Radio Show.
We'd like to wish you all a happy holidays from us at the GeoNiagara Radio Show.
Have a great holiday season. Enjoy your time with your family and friends, and we will see you in January.
Good night.
Good night.
You have been listening to the GeoNiagara Radio Show, sponsored by the Department of Geography and Tourism Studies at Brock University.